There's water right here for anything you'd like.
Can everybody hear me?
Great.
And thank you, Mary Ann. That was a great reading. Lovely. Thank you all for coming, and thank you, Deanna, for inviting me. It's great. I'm going to read from two books tonight. The first one I'm going to read from is from The Lake of Two Mountains, which was published about 4 years ago. And the reason I'm going to read from it tonight is because it's very Montreal. So The Lake of Two Mountains, as you probably all know, is just west of Montreal at the confluence of the Ottawa and St. Lawrence Rivers. And when I was young, my family and my sister and I would go to the lake for the entire summer and have a ball, and we learned to swim there and to boat there and just to enjoy ourselves. So when I wrote this, this was really a praise poem for the lake, because I really have so much to thank the lake for. So the first poem, I'll just read three or four poems from this book, and then I'll read from the more recent book. The first poem is called How Own a Lake, and when you're a child, you feel like you own everything. A child begins owning the lake, its lifting haunt in morning, its sun-slapped birds, begins to own the rud that coats evening, sunsets hinged behind the gap to the west, begins owning the islet that floats offshore, boulder pinned. She upends smaller stones, plucks innocent snails. She claims the islet's frogs and the rivets of frogs, moves the stirring lumps, owns the waves and the far shore that looses them, owns water lilies bobbing beneath the far end bridge, yards them out, lays them in layers on the rowboat's wet floor. She owns water weeds that yank at her feet, tadpoles butting which she collects, black leeches which she salts. And the monastery across the lake which she can't see, does she own it as well? And the reservation across the lake, completely unknown. The duck blind near the point she claims, and lapping sounds, and darning needles switching blue, and rapiers of grass, the briny pong, the smart of slime that chokes the small elbowed bay. And the lake. The lake begins owning the child, carves its winged shape into her young green stick bones, into places there where holiness will soak, and a loneliness she can't hope to shake. There was indeed a monastery across the lake that we didn't really see much of, and it was a Trappist monastery. It's no longer there as a monastery, but the building is still there. So I've written a few monastic life poems into this book, and I'll read you one of them. It's called Monastic Life Number 4. It resides with honeybees, rows of hives along wire fences to the west, each queen drowsing in the jellied center of a world. Bless each queen that she survives the freeze, that she recites sweet piping sounds in spring as icicles release the sun. Bless the orchard trees as they hold up their plain gray twigs. Fields of clover one day will levitate, hover in July's keening light. Bless the workers, too, dull huddled in their combs, that they remember flight, uncup their double wings against leftover cold. Bless each monk who dreams of honey, pantried light, stolen to illuminate dim winter shelves. They are praying for forgiveness and for blossoms to burst April buds. And this one is called Lake Number 2. Drawing cowls of quiet around uncertain space, sinking through pebbles and coarse grains of sand, no sound, it spreads into grass, lies flat for seasons, timeless, hovering even at shore, a presentiment a mirage. Shape-shifting mesmer, holding the surrounding rocks in place through reverence alone. The air above claims no geography. The lake needs nothing but river's brown mouth, solitary, quiet as the dragonfly that quilts nimbus gloss, as the eel that ribbons the squelch, as unlit fish surveying beneath serest weeds. Even when shirred, when breezes scoop atoms of foam, even when the world slants with rain and with wind, the lake won't complain. Nothing the ear can locate. Even in early morning, when heron spears frog, no sound will ring out. And I'm going to finish this Lake of Two Mountains reading with a poem that I dedicate to my uncle. We had a whole family there most of the time, and one of my uncles had been through the Second World War, and he never talked about the war and was very silent on most things. So this poem is called How Mend the Years. Let him sit on the beach, my uncle, in his lawn chair that folds like a stork, aluminum and shredded blue webbing, glass of Labatt's in his hand. Let him unreel the past on the waves, psalms, pastures, and lilies, the cosmos blooming, stargazing. A blur he can almost feel, made one with what he is seeing, lake and the line between water and sky. Let him hum without tune. He spools thin lines of bliss as if fishing, hitching this place to the quiet promise of peace, geography's comforting shape, this bluish brown water, this meniscus. Parasol sky, moving, unmoving, unhurried as prehistorical time. Let him memorize the lake's surface, find in what he sees there, something that mends. And now I'm going to read from The Girls with Stone Faces. And The Girls with Stone Faces are these two women, Florence Weil and Frances Loring. They're two very important sculptors who lived in Toronto almost all of their adult lives. And they were really prominent in the art world in Toronto when they were working, when they were making their sculptures. But then they seem to have just dropped off the whole side of the world. And when I go to read, I ask people if they've ever heard of Florence Weil and Frances Loring, and most people have not. Unless you're from Toronto, maybe, or maybe you're part of the art world or a sculptor yourself, but mostly they have been left behind. And so I first encountered these two women at the art gallery in Ottawa, the National Art Gallery, in a wonderful room. This is years ago, and there was all their work, and it was beautifully curated, and I was just smitten. And I thought, I need to find out about these two women, and I went home, and my partner, Chris, had a book about them. She had their first biography, so I read all about them and then started writing the poetry. So what I'm going to do is read the prologue to this poetry, and it's just a short paragraph that kind of locates you with these women. Florence Weil and Frances Loring met in 1906 at the Art Institute of Chicago. Florence was 26, Frances 19. They became close friends immediately. That first meeting they always described as a click experience. For almost 60 years, they lived their day-to-day lives, sculpted their neoclassical sculpture, made their living, and built their reputations as prominent Canadian sculptors together. For most of this time, they lived and worked in a deconsecrated church. They were pivotal in the art community in Toronto and were founding members of important national art organizations. Known as the Girls, their friends included A.Y. Jackson, Fred Varley, Arthur Lismer, and Emma Goldman. Their sculpture is displayed in public art galleries, in parks, on buildings, and on Parliament Hill. They died in 1968 in a nursing home within 3 weeks of each other and one floor apart. So this book contains poetry that's called ekphrastic poetry, which is poetry about art, and it also contains biographical poetry, poetry about their lives together. So I'm going to read some of both of these, and the first poem that I'm going to read is called Torso Number 2. I have a number of torso poems in here. There's a beautiful sculpture by Florence Weil called Torso, Mother of the Race, that was completed in 1930. Beautiful marble, and it is now kept in the National Gallery of Canada in Ottawa, but you can't always see it because, as we know, most of the art is kept in the vaults. So, but I happened to see it this particular day, which was a miracle for me. Torso number 2. Considering you, mother of the whole human race, past, present, whatever comes next, Jeanne d'Arc, her impossible stance, and Edith Cavell, Pussy Riot, their faces too young on the screen, not giving up, Rosa Parks, Harriet Tubman's stout trust. Considering yours as if you are holding your breath, taught, as if teaching the right way to stand, demonstrating how to persevere, each rib accounted for, each muscle, belly, buttock, shoulder to hip, tipped, the whole on a slight turn, the shoulders on an almost imperceptible slant, your skin, dolomite marble, shadowed, opening to light. How you mean to safeguard, protect, even though you lack eyes, ears, lack a whole human face. And so these two work together, as I said in the prologue, that they work together in this church. They needed large ceilings because their work was often very large, and they lived in the church vestry at the same time. But the finishing touches on all of the sculptures were done in this particular church. So this poem reflects a little bit of their life together. It's called No Side Saddle Beauty. She straddles the bench, boots blunt on the floor, the knife in her hand, a penknife, sharp, shining steel, sharp as the woman's right eye slices away at the lower half of the baby's wet ear. Her apron is canvas, clotted with clay, grit, mud of the day, damp parings the size of sow bugs or the wings of a fly. The apron, her hair, her trousers, all dunnish gray. She slices the spot where the baby's ear bridges the baby's lined skull, the spot where the small lobe perfects its pendulous curve, almost unweighted, unfixed. Across the room, which is not an overlarge room, another woman masses in her deep velvet chair. With her left hand, she cradles the black phone, casts her eyes to the woman who whittles in the baby's fine face. A kind of love, deliquescence, permeates this space. In her right hand, the morning's fourth cigarette. This poem is called Say, and it's written after Laurie D. Graham's poem called Rove. Say terracotta, say this dense complication of earth, say dirt, say mud the color of rust, say clay, dry stone, say dry riverbed, say river, bed with old springs, open the windows in mid-July. Say, plaster is stone, with or without pigment applied, limestone calcified. Say, granite is igneous, Say, biceps hard as petrified wood. Say, future is harder than past. Tip of the iceberg, say, tongue. Gravity, symmetry, multiverse, say, holes in sculptural art have no part in or out of the torso. Say, holes do not belong in a column of stone, upright or in recline. Say, classic. Say, the core holds, smooth as the Tiber at night. Say, tongue, touch, greed. Say, I want. Say, I want patina, smooth as a river, a mother's breast, a keen hunger for satin to handle. Say, silk, silky nature. Say, between the two thighs, surface, surface tension. Say, arrested motion. Meniscus, say spill, say palms oiled in sweat, say opposable thumbs, fingers, tips as knowing as a black ant's antennae, sonar, bat wings, knowing as photons as smell, knowing as bodies in summer's impossible heat, say nipples, eye to eye, say come over here. So they actually grew old together, and over time, Frances grew blind, which made it very hard for her to continue with her artwork, and she also had pretty bad arthritis, so her life at the end was not very easy. This poem is called Frances Grew Blind. A small bird perched on her table, its head cocked to one side, in its beak the word crust. The weather pulled it from one end of the day to the other, morning to night. At night, Frances saw into her past, past mountains and rivers, traffic, black ice. As a child, she could fly. As a child, she swam currents of conversation, their sense nothing but tone, pulling her morning to night in short spurts. If she could see the way she once saw, the way a mountain sees into a river, miles away into the bed of the river, what is strewn on the bed, microscopic, wet worms, tiny blue clams, fish scales, nematodes, bits of teeth. The river sees what lies on its banks, branches, wing feathers, moles, moss, leather soles. How life begins its slow twist into death. She saw the shape of the bird before it arrived. It flew in from the day she turned 9, a fall day with more tone than cool air. Landing now, a ghost landing. She covered her teacup with her left hand, her mouth with her right. So as I said, they worked very hard at their sculpting and actually managed to make their living as sculptors, which was a no mean feat in the 30s and 40s. So this poem is called Industry, describes their lives working together. They left their heads, their bodies, all over the place. They never stopped making. When one was sold, another was chiseled, another sanded, one more polished, one more on display. 3 left the exhibit. They could hardly keep track. Some they left on the faces of banks and big shops, inside and out. 2 guarded a highway. They left their own heads in a small park, a parquette, in an alcove, vaults. The war bronzes they left in the Museum of War. The woman with a stone dish on her shoulder now bends over the Bain family's fountain. 1 or 2 monuments were left on Parliament Hill. A foot soldier was left near the ocean. All over the place, they lost track, in Toronto, St. John, Ottawa, and in Niagara Falls. 1, maybe 2, they lost in New York. Some left the country for good. Some stayed in private collections. Some live on the shelves in the basements of galleries, in numbered cabinets with glass doors and locks. They left their life in the church on Glen Rose, got into the car that drove them away, never looked back. And I just have two more poems. One is called Guide to the Plants of Toronto. The year they died together, Francis and Florence, though apart by one floor and 3 weeks. That year, the parks in Toronto, waiting at the time, winter time, when they died, for the plants, for the ferns, flowers, cattails, arum, and duckweed, scouring rush, to break through the frost-hardened soil, waiting for the ice to break open, for the soil to go soft as brown sugar. And though neither Francis nor Florence would have remembered the names of the plants, plants they had known for the past 50 years, plants along the boulevards and creek beds of Moore Park, of Mud Creek and Yellow, on Glen Rose and on St. Clair, in their backyard. That year, the Botany Group of Toronto Field Naturalist Club produced an olive green booklet, a checklist of plants in the city to guide walkers through parks with their children and dogs, life going on without the two women, twigs and beggar stick burrs. The way Francis had once walked Delilah and Samson, and some days Florence would walk with them too. Ask whether a green shoot might be skunk cabbage or white or maybe yellow trout lily, and if that yellowish clump might be wolfia or crimson fern. Jack in the pulpit, they both knew without doubt. And this last poem is called I'm Still in Love, because I never actually fell out of love with these two women. They were always, through the whole time I was writing this, really, really important and very alive to me. Three quarters, halfway, half in, half past, maybe four-fifths. The measure is not important. When love enters, it clears the blue sluice, clears all imperfections. Gray haze, the blind in the eyes, nighttime, minds, the interstices of soul. In love with these two, the idea of, as if they almost were one. I tell you this, they were gods, nor would they allow the term sculptress, as in less, the gendered hierarchical split. They did not accept less, or allow hunks of clay to be gouged from inside the hole, or allow the trivial, or the absurd, or unsightly. These two and their 400 works, unsullied, or 379, the precise count, unimportant. When love enters, it feels more than space, or a ledger, or time. I'm telling you this, these two are deities, far back, perpetuity. When divinity enters, it enters through the crown chakra, without volition or violence. The top of your head, the crown is violet, breaks into sky. Thank you.